Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, freedom for the thought we hate. My guest is two-time Pulitzer winner and longtime op-ed columnist for the New York Times, Anthony Lewis. Lewis's 50 years at the New York Times and years beforehand at other papers earned him the two Pulitzers for covering everything from the McCarthy era, civil rights, the Vietnam War, the plight of Soviet Jewry, the struggle for freedom in South Africa, and the plight of Nelson Mandela. Lewis was bombed by American warplanes while covering the Vietnam War in North Vietnam, traveled to China when virtually no one could get into that country, and around the world. His knowledge of world leaders stems from just about everyone you can think of over the last 60 years. His books include Portrait of a Decade about civil rights, Gideon's Trumpet, Make No Law about the First Amendment, and now his new book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, about core constitutional and legal issues, a specialty that Lewis grew into over his many years. In fact, he was the first full-time Supreme Court reporter ever. Now, if this sounds like a bit of a boastful and excessive introduction, in the interests of full disclosure, I have to admit, he's my father. Continuing now with Anthony Lewis, the former New York Times columnist and author of the new book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. It was really the last 100 years where the First Amendment was brought through the Supreme Court and tested. Can you sort of briefly describe some of the cases that came before the court, the core principles that were being tested, and what happened?
Well, the very first case in which anyone ever won a case under the First Amendment freedom of expression clauses, quite remarkably, came in 1931, 140 years after the amendment was added to the Constitution. That was a case about a woman named Yetta Stromberg, who had violated a California law against carrying a red flag. Now, that shows you something about the time of fear of radicalism, made it a crime to walk down the street carrying a red flag, which was a symbol of radicalism. And she was convicted, and the Supreme Court reversed that conviction, saying she had a right to express her views with what we call symbolic speech, the waving of a red flag. And the case that you'll know better, a much more recent case, as the case that held that burning a flag in a political demonstration was protected by the First Amendment. Well, that was 1931, and the same year, the court for the first time enforced the Freedom of the Press Clause. That was a case in which a newspaper in Minneapolis, Minnesota, had been shut down under a rather strange Minnesota law that allowed the suppression of malicious newspapers. And this was a very malicious newspaper, a nasty paper, run by a man called J.M. Neer, and the case is called Neer against Minnesota, and the Supreme Court held that a prior restraint, that is, squashing something before it's published, refusing to let it be published, is the worst kind of unfreedom and inherently suspect and should not be allowed.
And some of the other major cases?
Well, we've had lots of cases saying that obscenity, supposed obscenity, cannot be stopped if there is any redeeming social interest in the publication. You know, we used to ban things like James Joyce's novel Ulysses and D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover, serious novels. Certainly Ulysses is regarded as maybe the greatest novel of the 20th century. It was banned. You couldn't bring it into the United States until a judge invoking the First Amendment said you couldn't stop that. There are all kinds of speeches advocating, in a theoretical way, revolution. This country needs a revolution, that sort of statement. The Supreme Court has said that you can't ban or punish speech urging revolution or urging violence unless it's likely to produce, unless it's really calculated to bring about immediate violence and is likely to produce that. The case that really tested us was a case out in Illinois, in a suburb of Chicago called Skokie, Illinois, where, as it happened, a number of Holocaust survivors lived, and as a provocative act, the American Nazi Party proposed to have a march through Skokie. Well, you can't imagine anything more awful. And the courts held that they were allowed to march, that we were sufficiently strong as a country and a people to let these loathsome people demonstrate. Well, as soon as they won the case, they didn't march because all they were trying to do was provoke. So I should tell you that in terms of our, it's not so recent now, but it's recent to me, the Pentagon Papers case, when the New York Times began publishing a secret official history of the origins of the Vietnam War, how we got into the Vietnam War. And the United States government, the Nixon administration, went to the courts to suppress that publication, to order the New York Times not to publish the documents. It was exactly like the Near case in 1931, but far more serious because it wasn't one crank newspaper in Minnesota. It was a leading newspaper trying to tell secrets about a war that was deeply dividing America, whose origins were a question of real national interest. And the Supreme Court held, by a vote of 6-3, that the New York Times could publish. So that's maybe the most consequential example of how the First Amendment works.
You've talked about Justice Holmes and Justice Brandeis and Justice Frankfurter. Are there particular justices? I mean, Supreme Court justices are your heroes. are there particular justices whose opinions have mattered the most in the battle for free expression?
Well, Holmes and Brandeis, as you've just mentioned, have mattered greatly. They dissented alone between 1919 and for the next 10 years, I should say. And their opinions, though just dissents, were so rhetorically brilliant and so, you know, so strong that they persuaded the country, in effect, that free speech was important and persuaded eventually by 1931 a majority of the court. A later judge who was on the court when I covered it was Hugo L. Black. Justice Black wrote an opinion of his own in the Pentagon Papers case in 1971 that's, I think, worth quoting, and I'll read you just a bit. The press was protected in the First Amendment, he said, so that it could bear the secrets of government and inform the people. Only a free and unrestrained press can effectively expose deception in government. And paramount among the responsibilities of a free press is the duty to prevent any part of the government from deceiving the people and sending them off to distant lands to die of foreign fevers and foreign shot and shell. Pretty strong.
Mm. One of the things you write about is how the press has evolved. I mean, I remember looking at, this is going to be embarrassing, your wedding license at one point, and it didn't describe you as a journalist. It described you as a newspaper man, which, you know, sounds sort of like exterminator or something. You know, it just has the sort of front page, seedy, fedora wearing, whiskey chugging kind of image to it, you know, newspaper man. But you write on page 145, if you wouldn't mind reading in the middle of the page, in the mid-20th century.
I remember when certainly newspaper man was the common phrase, but I say in the book, in the mid-20th century, American reporters began drinking white wine instead of whiskey out of paper cups. They had college, some even graduate degrees, and their ambitions climbed. They wanted to be in Washington, the center of the world. They wanted to go to dinner parties with the Secretary of State. That is a bit of a caricature, but not much. Reporters used to be outsiders, badly paid. Now they, or at any rate those in Washington, and others among the top in the profession, are part of the establishment, upper middle class in outlook. They call themselves journalists instead of reporters. There is a danger in all that, the danger of becoming too close to power. It is a palpable danger in Washington. Writing critically about a cabinet member is hard after sitting next to his or her spouse at a dinner party.
You go on by describing the great British columnist Bernard Levin of the Times warning about this. If you could continue.
He used the word responsibility in a British sense, meaning sort of part of the political establishment. And he wrote, "The press has no duty to be responsible at all, and it will be an ill day for freedom if it should ever acquire one. We are and must remain vagabonds and outlaws, for only by so remaining shall we be able to keep the faith by which we live, which is the pursuit of knowledge that others would like unpursued and the making of comments that others would prefer unmade."
His point being, you know, exactly what you're writing about on the page previous, how far American reporters have gone from that earlier age and perhaps and how they were perceived by the likes of Madison. You spoke about the incredible failures of American reporters in the lead up to this most recent Iraq war. In terms of the First Amendment, what do you think of the current Supreme Court?
Well, one of the oddities, shall we say, surprising events about the First Amendment is that today, support for freedom of expression, free speech, and freedom of the press goes right across the spectrum of Supreme Court justices. In the past, it was the conservative justices who were favored repression of unhappy speech, unwelcome speech, radical speech, and the more libertarian justices like Holmes and Brandeis and Black who wanted to protect it. But today, I think most judges are committed to freedom of speech and press, and I give you the instance of Justice Scalia, who's widely regarded as the most, or the leading conservative, as it's called, on the court. But he's, though he's conservative in some respects, he's all out for freedom of speech, and for example, he made the fifth vote in the 5-4 decision allowing the burning of the flag. So I don't know that there is a great difference on the First Amendment. There are sharp differences, very sharp differences on other issues, but not on the First Amendment.
There's another opinion in the book that you write about, which is an important, wonderful piece of writing from a judge probably most legal scholars have never heard of, not a Supreme Court justice, but a judge in Montana.
Yes, a federal judge in Montana, George Borkman. He was at a time when this fear that we spoke of before, the fear in time of war, was at its height during World War I, 1918, and most states had copied the Sedition Act of the federal government and punished all kinds of speech that they thought was unpatriotic. In Montana, people were punished for saying that the food rationing system wasn't workable, and lots of them were punished for remarks they made when they were drinking too much in a bar, and really crazy stuff. Judge Borkman, in part thanks to him, and in part thanks to a very fine prosecutor, Burton K. Wheeler, who later became a famous senator from Montana, thanks to those two, there were no successful prosecutions under the Espionage Act, the Federal Espionage Act in Montana. A man who'd been convicted of sedition under the Montana law, the state law, sedition, I remind you, quote, sedition, unquote, for refusing to kiss the American flag, a wonderful ground for convicting someone of sedition. That person who had been convicted sought to get himself free by petitioning the federal judge, Judge Borkman, and Borkman decided that the federal judge could not interfere in a state matter. But he went on to write, like religion, patriotism is a virtue so indispensable and exalted that its excesses pass with little censure. But when it descends to fanaticism, it is of the reprehensible quality of the religion that incited the massacre of St. Bartholomew, the tortures of the Inquisition, the fires of Smithfield, the scaffolds of Salem, that was the witch trial, and is equally cruel and murderous. In its name, as in that of liberty, what crimes have been committed. In every age, it too furnishes its heresy hunters and its witch burners, and it too is a favorite mask for hypocrisy, assuming a virtue which it haveth not.